The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
All right, so we barely started this last time, and first we're going to be dealing with Conrad Lawrence this week. I don't know if we'll finish or not. I would like to try to finish. Lawrence's knowledge of animal behavior is or was very great, and I enjoy both his principles and his examples a lot. He doesn't cover social behavior so much. It's a distinct thing. And he doesn't deal with classes of behavior and different functions. He has his own method of dealing with the behavior of individual animals. But it's very useful in thinking about things that we'll be dealing with later in the class. So let's start with this. He points out that when Heinroth and others first wrote about what's become known as the fixed action pattern or instinctive movement, the concept really, they didn't separate these three different functions that were all part of any instinctive motor pattern. So you should know what they are, and I've written them here for you. We've already talked at least briefly about these. The first is the drive. When an animal is more motivated to perform a motor pattern, he won't perform it if there's no stimulus. And if there's no stimulus there, he will look for it. And that's what we often call a drive. It's the appetitive behavior of an animal with an appetite for something specific. And what he's looking for is a stimulus. And if he comes upon the stimulus, which may not be visual, but it may be, he will respond to it. In many cases, his recognition is innate, but not so many times it's learned components. Lawrence deals with that later. And that we call the innate releasing mechanism. Okay. The stimuli that release it are frequently called key stimuli. We're going to discuss key stimuli a bit. Because sometimes an action pattern does not require innately determined key stimuli. There are exceptions to that. But in many cases, it's an innate recognition. And other concepts associated with that we'll be dealing with, especially next time. Okay, and then finally, the discharge of the innate motor pattern. This is the consummatory behavior. And in this case, there's less, often no learning involved for the basic pattern, although different motor patterns are linked, as we've mentioned, by learning. Okay. So now, what are intention movements? And how are they related to fixed action patterns? Yes?
Can I have a question?
Sure.
The last one, the third one, the definition of a race car?
Yes. It's not the same as a reflex in that the reflex doesn't include one, for example. It doesn't include repetitive behavior. Okay. But reflexes are closely related in that there is a specific stimulus that elicits it. In many cases, it's unlearned. Those are the unconditioned reflexes. Then we can learn the conditioning processes. If we, with associative learning, we can develop conditioned reflexes too.
So is that the only difference between reflex and fixed action pattern? There's no
drive. And mainly, it's something inside that gives this drive to search. That's right. It's the motivational state that's different. Now, they are often much more complex in addition. There are fairly complex reflexes, but most reflexes are not as complex as these fixed action patterns. But there are also examples of fixed action patterns which are quite simple, like the eye blink. But that brings up a point that I made before. I'll make it again right now. In that, in textbooks, when people name reflexes, they're often talking about fixed action patterns, because there is a motivational component, like the eye blink or swallowing or even sneezing. We think of them as reflexes. Okay, and they are triggered because even though there is appetitive behavior, there is an action-specific potential in the theoretical terms of Lorenz. The major thing is the main thing that increases that internal drive is the stimulus itself. Okay. So sometimes it gets a little complicated trying to separate them, but many reflexes are very easy to separate. They're the ongoing things that keep us upright, that keep our feet away from fires and sharp things and things like that that happen all the time. Okay. That when they're discharged, we don't lose the ability to make that movement for a while like we do with most fixed action patterns. That's another major difference. All right, what are intention movements? We're still talking about fixed action patterns. I want you to give me an example. Lorenz is often giving his stories of his geese. Occasionally he'll give a story of jackdaws, which he studied earlier, but most of the time he spent a larger amount of his life studying geese. But he gives examples from other animals as well and from human behavior. What is an intention movement? Somebody? Yes?
When the geese swing are all half open and then still big, like stop chicken over the geese
about to fly. About to fly. That's a good way to put it. Something about to happen, but it doesn't fully happen. His example that I like is he says, I can always impress visitors by saying, look at that goose. It thinks it's going to fly, but it won't, and have my prediction come true. What does he mean? Because he sees intention movements of the goose where he initiates some of the early part of starting to fly. Why does he know, in some cases, that the goose isn't going to take off? He just shows the intention movement. What gives the clue? He didn't even know for a while, but then he figured it out. Yes?
Can we do the intention movement in a different way? Like, don't do it with less intensity or
less, three and then back. Less intensity, and the speed with which he goes from one step to the next is slower. And right, sometimes he'll drop back to an earlier level. So he knows the internal, the drive, the repetitive behavior simply isn't strong enough to lead to that behavior. Okay. Give me an example from human behavior. Yes?
When we're about to sneeze, we almost always jerk our heads back a little.
And sometimes we never sneeze.
Yeah.
We just show the initial part. Right. For something like locomotion, we're always showing it. I can tell by the intention movements if students really have to go someplace right after class, because they start not only start packing their books, they'll even make little movements towards the door. You know? And we all do things like that, often without even noticing it. We make intention movements. If we have a drive, an intention to do something, we have the motivation, but it hasn't quite reached the point of fully discharging. Okay. And then I want to point out one other thing here about intention movements and the evolution of social signals. Attention movements can evolve on their own if they come to serve as important social signals. And you'll see examples of that. Especially think of the ritualized aggression that we talked a little bit about with jackdaws. You know, these have evolved from actual fighting, but often we only see the intention movements. The actual fight is never finished. So these are like intention movements, but in evolution they become ritualized, okay, so that they become the way animals will settle differences without actually fighting. Okay. And sometimes animals' appearance will actually change in evolution to enhance the detectability or visibility of these intention movements. Okay, now he discusses, this is a section called Unity of Motivation. Often fixed action patterns are very complex. Now, we just had that question earlier, how can we distinguish reflexes and fixed action patterns? We said fixed action patterns not always, but are often more complex. And sometimes they're quite complex. They involve a whole series of movement. Like the goose taking off, he does things with his feet, and then he begins to move his wings. But he doesn't actually take off yet. As the intensity increases, his readiness to fly increases in intensity. He finally will begin to make the actual movements of flying. So when we're dealing with a series of movements like that, how do we know we're not dealing with different fixed action patterns? Yes?
Just a few things. First one was like being able to connect one based off what the
predictability
was.
Predictability, yes.
Second one was that it switches back and forth very quickly, very easily.
Right. This was mentioned here just a minute ago, that sometimes it slips back to the previous intensity movement. That's right.
And then lacking of, while looking at genuine intention movements, you can still see faces or not all there, but kind of lower intensity times, something like that.
Yeah, let's try to make that clearer. And I've separated into five. You had three. The first one you mentioned, consistent predictability. That means to a human observer, he can very consistently predict what action will follow the next, what action will follow the previous one in the series. And he talks about Zeitz's demonstrations of fighting behavior in his little fish he studied. He could narrate what was going to happen, and he could actually, when he was narrating, Lawrence noticed that he often would say something even just before it happened. He always seemed to know exactly what would happen next in the fighting behavior of these fish. And when intensity increases, you get these quick switches between patterns of behavior. But the sequence is always clear. You never get a higher stage jumping back two steps. It always goes to the adjacent one. Then he said that one stage will move quickly to the next without, if you were moving between different instinctive movements, it doesn't happen so fast. There's a kind of inertia he talks about between different instinctive movements. Probably the strongest arguments are the last two. The same stimulus configuration elicits all these motor patterns. Okay, in the case where it has a specific stimuli elicited. And he also points out there, sort of as an aside, that in some cases you can stimulate the brain, and from one point in the brain you get the whole sequence. That's not as strong an argument, because when we stimulate the brain, we may be stimulating more than one system. It's very hard to stimulate, to know that we're stimulating just one system of action. Okay. He thinks the strongest argument is the last one. It's also the hardest to understand. I've tried to summarize it there. The organism's readiness to perform any one part of the sequence fluctuates in parallel with its readiness to perform any other. So you never see a higher intensity movement immediately followed by one of lower intensity. If a strong stimulus can elicit only the earlier weaker movements, meaning his internal readiness isn't strong enough, okay, then that means you'll never be able to elicit, no matter how strong the stimulus, you'll never be able to elicit the higher intensity patterns, because it's all part of the same sequence, you see. So try to understand those arguments. It's pretty straightforward. But using these arguments, you can figure out whether you're dealing with more than one action pattern or not. That becomes pretty important in interpreting something like, say, the hunting behavior of the cat. We're going to come back to this. The cat, when he's hunting, what does he do? He lies in wait. He crouches in hiding. Before that, he's shown searching behavior. But let's say he's found his herd of antelope or whatever he's going to attack. We're talking about big cats. Okay. But there's this whole sequence. When he reaches the right, when the timing is right and he's close enough, then he will pounce. And that just initiates a further sequence of movements. He then has to kill the animal. Finally with a killing bite, okay, all innate, these animals. But there's this whole sequence. Do those fit this? The fact is they don't. They are separable, and you can see that especially by studies of development. And I've read some of Lehausen's studies of development of these action patterns, and you see quite clearly that they're initially separate. They become linked, okay, partly by learning in the development of the animal. Zeitz's method of dual quantification. He developed this to assess the effectiveness of a dummy stimulus. Now remember what a dummy stimulus is. Okay. A fake stimulus, often much simpler than natural stimulus, but that can elicit the behavior. But different dummy stimuli that may differ quite a bit from each other, like a stick versus a ball, can both elicit gaping responses in young birds. Now, how could you assess that one of them is stronger than the other? Yes?
The maximum stimulus,
yeah. Like
and
the natural
the
one.
The second one, the maximum stimulus elicits a lower response than he knows the fixed action patterns internally.
Yes, it's based on this phenomenon that when the animal discharges the full action pattern, okay, the internal readiness goes down. Okay, so now you can't elicit it at all right away, or if you can, you won't elicit the whole thing. You won't elicit the higher intensity component of it. Right, and you remember what Zeitz was studying? These fighting fish he studied? That had these whole sequences of behavior in their fights. So he would use the dummy, just to repeat what you said, he would expose them to the dummy, see what behavior he got, and then immediately afterwards he would expose them to the natural stimulus, the most effective stimulus for eliciting the behavior. And he would see how much they would do in response to that. Now, if the dummy had been very effective, they wouldn't respond as much to the high-intensity stimulus. If the dummy was less effective, they would respond much more. So he could use that method then to assess just how effective the dummy was. And that was how they found out that some dummies, you know, can be just as effective, and in some cases even more effective than the natural stimulus. Okay. And that's a problem. Zeitz doesn't, Lawrence doesn't deal with that issue. The supernormal stimulus right here. Once you discover the supernormal stimulus, then do you use that in these studies? But let's go on and talk about this law that Zeitz discovered in his studies of using dummy stimuli. What was it, this law of heterogeneous summation? He's talking about the stimuli that elicit fixed action patterns. Yes?
So when a stimulus has a certain ability to elicit a behavior on its own, it will have that same level of ability when combined with other stimuli.
But that's not the full explanation of what this law is. That's part of it. The key thing to remember is that the stimuli that release this fixed action pattern are, it's usually not a single element. There's multiple elements. Okay. Even if it seems very simple, it always appears at a certain height, for example, above the animal. That's part of the stimulus. Okay. It might be a certain color. That's part of the stimulus. Might be a certain shape. It might be a couple of things that have to be there. A couple of shapes. And basically, Zeitz claimed that when you can isolate these separate elements, that they, in their effect on the fixed action pattern, they simply summate. That's why Lawrence, when he's talking about it, tries to talk about nervous system as well, because it's similar to spatial summation in neurons. But of course here we're dealing with a much more complex system than a single neuron. So that's really all it means. You add up the stimuli, you get, if they're all part of the key stimuli, none of them are as effective. One is not as effective as two. Two are not as effective as three if there's three elements to the stimulus. Okay? Can somebody make this distinction for me? I think the best that the practical studies of these, the eliciting the gaping movements of these little birds, chaffinches, made that very clear. It's on page 119. We can look at that. I just want to see if any of you, without that, can just tell me. You should know by now. I've been following. Somebody else? Somebody that's not said anything yet? Yes?
Well, I think the actual specific fatigue is more to do with they're getting tired, from using the same muscles.
Fatigue here is a technical term. It doesn't necessarily mean the animal's getting tired as a whole.
Yeah,
he might be
like responding less, right?
Tired of that one thing, right? He will respond less. Okay, that's true. In either case, he responds less. So that doesn't distinguish these two. But what is the difference? They're both talking about responses to repeated stimulation. Okay?
Okay, I want to try again.
Try again.
I think with habituation what happens is the actual response goes down. Like, I'm thinking of like with action potentials, like habituation after a while, you know, there's like less of
when this, yes, normally habituation is used to talk about reactions to stimulation. When the stimulus is less novel, you get less of a response. Okay? It's always on the stimulus side. It's the adaptation means right at the receptor level, when the receptor can respond less if it's just been stimulated. You stimulate the receptor repeatedly, you can get adaptation of that receptor. Habituation is more central, okay, but it's still on the afferent side, side of sensory pathways. Action-specific fatigue, you get less response too, but now for a different reason. And how do we know? We can separate that. These are critical for understanding the validity of the kind of model that Lawrence talks about. Of course, when I say validity, there's no way an analogy can be perfectly valid, and his model is really only an analogy. But if we can embody the dynamics of his model in a simulation of the nervous system, which is what Blumberg has done here at MIT, these kinds of arguments are critical. We have to know what elements do we need in the model. The difference here, action-specific fatigue means a decrease in that internal readiness to respond, okay, the drive. The action-specific potential is the more neutral term that Lawrence likes. Don't confuse it with action potentials. Don't confuse it with membrane potentials. We're talking, it's a behavioral concept, okay? It refers to motivational state. Now, how did Prechtl note habituation in the releasing of these, that is, stimulating these gaping movements in young chaffinches? You remember? There's multiple aspects to the stimulus. The key stimuli have various aspects. He could habituate them. They stop responding to one aspect, and then he could introduce the next, and they would start responding again. Okay, so they were still perfectly ready to respond. But on the stimulus side, or let's say on the afferent side, they had habituated to some of them. Okay, so that then he knew, he was able to separate readiness to respond and habituation. With a decrease in action-specific potential, it didn't matter which stimulus he used. His response went down to all of them. You see? Yes? Once, when the action-specific potential goes down, which means we get some fatigue, okay, whenever the full action is elicited, okay, so whenever we blink our eyes, whenever I swallow, I'm much, much less likely to swallow again. Okay? Unless I do something to increase that internal readiness. How do I do that? I stimulate way in the back of the tongue. Slide your finger back over the little row of papillae, circumvallate papillae in the back of your tongue, and you will trigger swallow. Okay? But you won't trigger it immediately if you've just swallowed. But it's very quick. That's just the way that one works. Same for the eye blink. You'd be much less likely to blink your eyes if you've just blinked. But on the other hand, if you have something touch your eyeball, the increase in action-specific potential is almost instantaneous, and you will blink. So in that sense, it's very much like a reflex. Yes. Some of these things we're talking about don't show much habituation because there's very narrow stimuli that can elicit them. Okay, but whenever we can repeatedly apply a stimulus, okay, and get less and less response, even though there's still readiness to respond, then we would call it habituation. Read that on page 119, and you can check your understanding of that. Make sure you can separate these things. Now let's talk about what Lawrence calls tool activities. I usually call the multi-purpose movements, which a term he also uses. I just want to make sure you understand these and how their action-specific potential varies, a little different from many other movement patterns. So what are we talking about? What am I showing right now? It's a multi-purpose movement, locomotion, and it is a fixed action pattern. What does that mean? Why do I call it a fixed action pattern? Didn't I learn to walk? No. I didn't have to. I might have influenced a little bit by learning, but no. I walked because my nervous system elements controlling walking matured to the point where I could walk. And before that, no matter how much my parents tried to teach me to walk, I couldn't, because the neural apparatus wasn't mature yet. Once it was, they all said, "We taught him how to walk," but it's not true. I walked on my own. And if they had never taught me anything, I would have walked. And so would you, because it's a human fixed action pattern, it's a fixed action pattern in most animals. That's an example of a multi-purpose movement. Okay? But it has all the characteristics of a fixed action pattern that we're talking about. It's one in which the readiness to respond is quite high. It builds up quite rapidly. But in fact, if we've just been walking a lot, if we sit down, we're going to have less tendency to get up and walk again than if we haven't walked for a long time. You coop an animal up so he can't roam. You coop a horse up in a small pen so he can't run. His tendency to run, his desire to run, is what we say, okay, increases and increases. And then I was just visiting a nephew and niece with horses in Illinois, and because we were there, they wanted to let the horses out for a while before we rode them. No, they let them out for a while, and they ran like crazy all over the place. They ran in groups, they kicked their heels, they did all kinds of things, displaying the fixed action patterns of these plains living animals, because they've been deprived of that for a long time. Long time meaning a few days. Give me other examples of multi-purpose movements. It doesn't have to be from human behavior. Lawrence gives a few others, you remember? Sorry?
Flying and birds.
Yeah, flying and birds would certainly be multi-purpose. They use it for many things, many action patterns. Much of their appetitive behavior would depend on that. What about a rodent? What do rodents like to do?
Gnawing.
And they will gnaw. If you don't give them opportunity to gnaw, you know, they will gnaw at other things. Even on metal, if you keep them in metal cages, okay, because their internal readiness to gnaw will increase to the point where it doesn't take a normal stimulus to get them to do it. So there are many multi-purpose movements. You could say that reaching movements, orienting movements, a lot of these things play a role in many different action patterns. Okay. And many of them, at least, they have an action-specific potential that builds up quite rapidly. And which leads us to these questions. We've just been talking about really threshold lowering, releasing stimuli. Lawrence has some very good examples of it, section 7 of the book. He gives the practical uses of it. If you want to do selective breeding, if you want to have an easy time getting animals to breed, then you want to deprive the animals of any sexual behavior for a long time. You deprive the males of any such behavior for a long time, they'll be willing to mate with almost anything. And that's what you want, because you want them to mate with an animal that they might not like that much. But the more you deprive them, every animal looks good. They say men are like that too. He gives the example here from He says, if while on holiday in the south of Europe we pass by a butcher shop and we are hungry, which means our action-specific potential for our fixed action patterns of eating is high. Okay. We perceive the appetizing smell of raw beefsteak. But when we pass by the same shop after having dined well, we unambiguously smell carrion. A good example of what a threshold lowering effect with deprivation, non-discharge of a fixed action pattern. And of course his story about the ship's captain, is also will help you never forget that. This tramp steamer captain was a friend of Oscar Heinroth, described how when he had been away on a long voyage, when he came back, all the women in the city appeared to be very beautiful. For after he had been in port for some time, most of them seemed quite ugly. See, what's happened? The same phenomenon. See? And then he relates it to the love potion in the Faust story. With this potion inside you, you will soon see Helen of Troy in every woman. A love potion that simply causes the same thing to happen. Okay, that's related now to this next concept, which we've also mentioned. We should begin to understand it very clearly now. That the thresholds can get so low that almost anything, even unnoticed stimuli, will trigger it. We call that vacuum activity or in vacuo reactions. Okay? When I'm deprived of walking a long time, I get people, not just me, but you, all of us, will get fidgety. Okay? It's because our locomotion is triggered. That's why it's not good to keep people in a lecture hall too long at once without taking a break. They get more and more fidgety. And not only locomotion, but other things they'll be doing. Yes?
So what would you say is triggering activity in that case? Because it's not no stimulus, right? It's just minimal.
We think that what happens is that the stimuli, the trigger on the input side, the innate, what we call the innate releasing mechanism, which we'll talk more about next time, that the thresholds get so low that that mechanism is discharged.
Okay, because I thought Lawrence said in the reading that there had to be some sort of external stimulus, like when he was talking about the corner of the box.
There always appears to be some stimulus, but when you observe vacuum activity in animals, sometimes there really isn't any stimulus that we can define. Like you deprive a bird that catches insects normally. You deprive him of insects, so you feed him something else. Okay, right. But he's deprived of insects for a long time. We'll show feeding behavior. Lawrence described how when he was a kid, he saw this bird fly up and look like he's catching an insect and go down and make the motions of killing it and eating it. And he said he even climbed up to see if there were any insects up there. There weren't. The bird was showing in vacuo reactions. You don't always need stimuli. You probably need something to get it started, but you certainly don't need many stimuli to discharge the whole pattern. The grooming reactions of mice have been studied in this regard, where you can even amputate a limb so the animal never gets feedback, say from the front paw, and yet he will show the grooming, go through all the grooming motions, the fixed action pattern of grooming, to see without any of the feedback. He'll even make, you can tell by the way his shoulder's moving what he's doing if you know the grooming pattern well. And he will even move the shoulder so as to bring that foot to his mouth so he can moisten it, even though the foot's not there. I mean, this is an extreme example of exactly what you said.
Yeah, I kind of had a feeling of dog, and then
you see, that's right. Very good example. Dogs do the same thing that mice do there. Yes?
Are these some of the same stereotypic behaviors that...
Yes, they are. But when in captivity, when they're in a confined space, some of the stereotypic behaviors you get are distortions of the fixed action pattern that's been deprived. You know, for example, they will pace, of course, in an abnormal way, but they are discharging their locomotor fixed action pattern. And that may be part of a number of other, remember, it's a multi-purpose movement, so it will be part of the repetitive behavior of various drives. And you don't know for sure which one is most deprived of. Generally, only one of them at a time will cause the locomotion. Yes?
So if an animal treats a limb like it's really bad, like does the doing behavior, does that necessarily mean that they have some sort of like phantom limb sensation that's telling them it's still there? Or will they go through that behavior even if they don't wrongly perceive the limb is still there?
When humans do that kind of thing, they fantasize the object. Okay, so let's just assume animals probably do too, but we don't know. You know, something corresponding to that is probably going on in their nervous system. But that's how it would have to be studied to find that out. Presumably you could use imaging methods or recording from the brain to find that out. But in fact, we don't know at this point. I think these are all related questions, so maybe we'll get more of an answer here if we just go on with this. 10 we've actually answered already. Just wanted to remind you that was first defined by this guy Wallace Craig, an American, in 1918. It's a major component of most instinctive behaviors, the first component, okay, appetitive behavior. That's what he defined, and his paper goes through details of various ways that appetites are expressed by various kinds of appetitive behavior, and appetitive behavior can be a little different for different action patterns, but there's, in some cases, you can't tell for sure what behavior the animal is showing. An animal that's very thirsty will search in a way that's maybe fairly similar to if he's searching for food. If you knew the animal really well, you can probably tell the difference. Number 11 is a question that has led to arguments and fights among people. The idea of an appetite for aggression. Aggressive behavior patterns can be fixed action patterns, which means they have an action-specific potential, which means an animal will be motivated to aggress. And I wanted you to find that. Give examples of it.
There was a statement from the video we watched a week ago that said that Lawrence has a very controversial view on the theory of aggression, that if you cannot form aggression, you cannot form friendship. Is that what he meant? That aggression and other more amicable bonding are the same thing, that you need one to have the other one?
I don't know if everyone would agree with that part of it, but what's most controversial is that you can have an appetite, a desire to be aggressive, and that can be built in, innate. Okay? People don't have as much problem accepting that in animals, but to say that humans are like this, that's where people start to object. And if you deprive some of these fighting fish of aggression, you know, you can begin to get in vacuum activity, aggressive behavior. He talks about the male, the roosters that will attack their own tail. You know, any slight stimulus, and it can be they're coming from themselves, they will lead to the attack behavior. But they don't do that if they've just been fighting. But you deprive them of fighting for a long time, and that happens. I can remember, maybe it says the kind of high school I went to, but when I was in high school, some guys had more of an appetite for aggression than others. It was probably to some degree in all of us, and it was certainly higher in the males than in the females. But they simply had to fight once in a while. If they'd just been fighting, they'd quiet down, they'd be calm for a while, and then they'd come back to it. You know. Maybe it's good that we have these violent games. I used to scratch my head and wonder, should I really be letting my son do all these computer games? They're so aggressive, conquering the world, splattering blood all over the place and everything. But at least he was discharging some motivational state there. Maybe they play that role. I'm just guessing here, but it's probably true that even people have that appetite for aggression. It doesn't mean, and Lawrence never said, you can't develop ways to control it. Okay, he's just trying to state the facts, what we're like, and what animals are like. And certainly species differ a lot in how much of an appetite for aggression they show. He points out, he says, polemic should be kept out of a textbook, but he can't help but mention about a well-known German journal, actually a popular science journal. They published an article by these two people that described the spontaneity of aggression in animals, and they put the title, Spontaneity of Aggression? No. But the title contradicted what the actual article said. See, the editors didn't want to imply that people do that, so they just changed the title. Knowing, of course, that most people wouldn't read more than the title in the first paragraph. But it's not controversial among scientists that study behavior. Okay, now this might sound similar to what we've just been saying. I said that multipurpose actions have a more rapidly increasing action-specific potential. Okay, more likely to appear in vacuo. But what's the more general rule that Lawrence states? The principle here, or general rule, it's really a descriptive rule based on many observations of behavior that show how this internal readiness or action-specific potential varies among different fixed action patterns. What's the general rule? How does the speed at which it builds up vary? How could you predict that just by observing the behaviors of the animal? Nobody remembers? Simply the frequency with which that behavior occurs in the natural life of the animal. And one of the best studies of that is in the attack behavior, aggressive behavior of cats, domestic cats and other cats that were studied by Paul Lehausen, in which he observed the various fixed action patterns involved in attack in the hunting behavior of the cat. But think of it. What do they have to do the most? Searching and stalking. They have to do that the most, because many times they will do that and they never go beyond that, right? Because it doesn't work. They never get close enough to the prey to pounce and so forth. And they will pounce much more often than they will actually do the actions of killing the animal. Because often they pounce and the animal gets away. They might touch it only. I mean, many of the animals they hunt are faster than they are, you know. And so once they're warned, they're gone. And then the behavior that the cat does the least is the killing bite. Because when he gets to that, it means he's succeeded to the point where he can kill the animal. So he shows that much less. Well, the action-specific potential for these various things builds up the fastest for the things he does the most. And since the intensity varies so much, that means, you know, that we should see evidence of that in cat behavior. And in fact, you do. I used to hear all the time that these predatory animals will never kill more than it can eat. That's absolutely not true. If they're deprived of killing for a long time, they will definitely kill and not eat. Even a domestic cat, which doesn't get a chance to hunt very much. Now, sometimes they lose that. That's a whole other area. If an animal doesn't get opportunity to express fixation patterns, some of them will at least well sort of decay. Then the nervous system elements aren't discharged for a long period of time. They can disappear. But for a more normal cat, okay, they will definitely kill. And you've all seen cats playing with a mouse? You know, what is he doing? Is it really play? No, he's going through some of the early stages, but the ASP for the killing bite isn't high enough. Because it doesn't build up as fast. So he doesn't need it as often. So that's the general rule. And he has nice description. Lawrence has nice descriptions of that. It builds up at a rate proportional to how often the action's needed. So when it builds up faster, it appears less susceptible to fatigue, and the action's more likely to be discharged in vacuole or with very little stimulus. I just talked about the varying motor patterns involved in prey catching. Lawrence talks about flying in various birds versus flying in gray-legged geese. The little birds are flying all the time. He describes one European tit, but many small birds are the same. They're flying all the time. Okay, whereas the gray-legged goose doesn't fly very often, so the action-specific potential simply doesn't build up as fast. So this rule holds across animals as well as within an animal. Okay, so it's a good one to be familiar with. Well, I've got to 13 already. We don't have to say much more about that. They don't hunt in order to eat. They hunt in order to hunt, because that's the fixed action pattern. Eating is separate from hunting, okay? And I know we have to quit. Read about that one, but that's a very fascinating one about the birds that use prying, either with their bills or with a little stick. The cactus finch picks up a little spine, cactus spine, to pry into areas to get insects. If you don't let them do that for a long time, they'll grab a stick and pry into anything, just to discharge that behavior. Okay, that's all for today.